The young are turning up saying, we are starving for answers to real human questions. How do I find my way? How do I find it? We're living in a meaning crisis. And when it really comes down to it, the young are hungry. And the question is, are we going to give them something to eat?
What does it mean to be human? Who are we? And what are we supposed to do about it? Most universities shrink from these questions. They know that they don't have good answers, so they basically avoid these questions.
All we can try to do as a university is to be a place where they can encounter, within a context of genuine freedom of friendship, the fundamental questions of what's been thought about them in the past.
This is, of course, at this point, extremely countercultural and radical and wonderful. Most people listening have forgotten who Boethius is.
This little book, which was written in the last weeks of his life, is effectively on the bestseller list in the West for 1,500 years.
Welcome to Socrates. In the city in which I find myself today is London. We're doing a Socrates in the studio here. If you like these conversations, please be absolutely sure to subscribe. It's very important. If you don't particularly like these conversations, also subscribe anyway. Thank you. My guest today for this conversation here in London is Stephen Blackwood. He is the founding president of Ralston College. He studied classics as an undergrad, received an MA in classics from Dalhousie, and a PhD in religion from Emory. He's held visiting positions at Harvard University, University of Toronto, and the University of Cambridge. Stephen, welcome.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, it's good to talk to somebody about education. And I also want to talk to you about Boethius. And I know you know nothing about Boethius, but you're going to make it work. You'll make it work. No, I do want to talk to you about Boethius. I want to talk to you first about your love of the classics and your founding of Ralston College, which means we're broadly speaking about education.
Okay, where should we start?
What's your story? Who founds a college? I mean, you know.
Well, I mean, man, looking back, if we knew how hard it was going to be. We might have thought twice. Your question about who founds a college though, is an interesting place to start.
Because... Other than John Harvard, no, but I mean, that's not everybody. Not only do most people not found colleges, almost no one thinks of the idea of founding. It's a grand enterprise. So my real question is, what led you to that?
Sure. And it's just worth saying, though, in the fact that it seems very idiosyncratic to start a college now, that's indubitably the case in, you know, 2026, not a lot of people starting new institutions of higher education. But I do think it needs to be said that that is actually the ahistorical position. If you think about, just to take the United States for an example, there's what, depending on how you count, two-year, four-year, accredited, non-accredited, but there's like 4,000 or 5,000 institutions of higher education in the United States. Most of them founded between the late 18th and early to mid-20th century. I think if you do the math on that, you'll find that that's a new college being founded about every other week for a century and a half.
So it sounds like every 10th person in America founded a college.
Well, of course, there's a lot of them, but I think the point that it's trying to make is that actually, what the tradition tells us is that it's not unusual to start new things. That's the principle of keeping the flames alive, right? I mean, it's actually the static moments are the times when it's dead. Mm. And we think, oh, no, we're just kind of live in the shadow of these collapsing institutions and so on. In our case, though, I mean, you can approach the matter in a number of different ways. Let me say just a couple. First, you know, there's been a lot of critiques of higher education, of the problems in higher education. We could get into that. If we wanted to at some length, for a pretty close to 100 years. But certainly, you know, most people would point to William F. Buckley's book, God and Man at Yale, as a kind of text of, let's call it, commentary or criticism about American higher education. That's in, I think, 1951 or 52.
No, I often cite that because I was at Yale in the 80s,
okay.
And it was already unraveling, but then I realized Buckley wrote his book about the Yale of the 40s,
yeah.
And it was already going dramatically south, if it had already gone south dramatically by then, which is, most people wouldn't realize that.
So, you know, Buckley's one, then you think you've got Alan Bloom, Closing the American Mind, 30 years later. That's now 40 years ago. So, you know, we've not lacked for clarion voices of criticism. And, you know, the problems, I don't like even getting into them because I don't think you can build anything out of critique, out of diagnosis. You know, you can only build out of a positive vision. But nonetheless, it's important to be forthright and candid and sober about where we are, whether those are problems of cost, indoctrination, ideology, infantilization of students, student loan crisis, no matter how, you know, the vocationalization of the university. We could get into any of these things if you like, but, you know, for a long while, I've more or less accepted the argument of the long march through the institutions, that the universities, the argument goes, are the most upstream influence on our culture at large. And if you think of them as a, I don't know, like a water main coming into a town, that whatever you put into that water main, you know, fluorine or chloride or whatever, if, when it comes into the town, it goes everywhere. Right, you don't get to say in the third floor bathroom, well, I don't feel like any chlorine in my water today. No, it's in there going everywhere. And so the idea is, when we talk about arts and culture or politics or our civic life or even our sense of ourselves, how we imagine and conceive the world, all of this in some sense, I'm not saying it's an absolute in all the cases everywhere, but in some profound sense, the universities are in this upstream influence of setting the tone of the ideas that work their way through everything. And so the first argument for starting a new college, if you would say, as I do, that for too long has been dominant, a kind of neo-Marxist, kind of nihilist perspective, it's closing the horizon, it's teaching us that there is no truth but only power, and that corrodes everything it touches, because you can't have any human relationship by that standard. It's all just the domination of one by another. It's a cynical standpoint through to the bone. There's no truth, beauty, goodness, forgiveness, justice, redemption. All of those are off the table. As you well know, those are just constructs of an underlying will to power. Well, of course, that view is preposterously wrong, destructive. We see its consequences, its poisonous fruit all around us. But if you accept that the universities play, as much as you might not like it, and again, I'm not a catastrophist. There's lots of great people teaching here and there, wonderful institution. But if you think, broadly speaking, we have a systemic problem, then, you know, the answer would be something like, you know, competition, Schumpeterian creative destruction. You say, well, let's see if we can just do better. Let's see if we can create a new alternative. Maybe it's based in, you know, thinking from first principles and the tried and the true, the things that have worked in the past. We're not innovators particularly. So that'd be the first reason to do that. But there's actually a bigger reason, I would say. And so I accept the argument that we need Schumpeterian creative destruction at all levels of our culture. That's to say, positive new beginnings that shine a light again about human nature, about dynamism and truth and beauty. We desperately need those new shoots growing up. But, you know, so I accept the, let's call it the systemic argument. But I think there's a bigger and a more urgent moral argument now, and that is, imagine that an emaciated, this is a powerful and I know kind of gruesome image, but imagine a starving young mother and her three emaciated children show up at your door, knock, say, Eric, please, can you give us something to eat? We are starving. And imagine your response is, that's very unfortunate, but what you need to do is, if you take a left and a right and a right and a left, and you go down here, there's this thing called the food bank. Now, we both know it doesn't have any food, but you should go there anyway, and you should talk to them about this problem. Well, for too long, that's what so-called conservatives have been doing with the young. The young are turning up saying, we are starving for answers to real human questions. How do I find my way? How do I find it? We're living in a meaning crisis. And when it really comes down to it, the argument for new institutions, especially new institutions of higher education, is that the young are hungry. And the question is, are we going to give them something to eat? Quite apart from, well, can we change the system? Well, can we do this? What if this isn't around 100 years from now? None of that matters. The people are banging on the door. Give them something to eat. That's why start a new college. That's what we're about at Ralston.
What were you doing before starting Ralston?
Well, I had worked in a very sort of nonprofit context. I'd played a role in helping to co-found an inner-city youth mentoring organization and a for really, depending on what you say, at-risk or underprivileged youth coming from extremely difficult backgrounds. So with others, I played a role in trying to do something meaningful in a community with those young people. I had taught at the university level, most immediately before...
Taught what?
Taught in a kind of core text, core ideas of the West program. And my background is in ancient medieval philosophy. I'm essentially an intellectual historian by training. My all-consuming intellectual passion is, what is the human being? What are we? How and what... What does it take for a human being to realize its potential that only it can realize, only he or she can realize? This is my all-consuming question.
And that's a very Western question, and it's certainly not something that the cultural Marxists are that interested in.
Well, it's actually, I'm glad you said that, because, you know, you couldn't so much as, plant a tulip without knowing something about tulips and where they grow, what kind of soil, how often to see, water them, what kind of sunlight. But for goodness sakes, you couldn't begin to answer the question of culture, which is really just the soil human beings are growing in, without knowing what a human being is. I mean, you have to have anthropology. You have to have a sense of, well, what is this thing? And I mean, I admit it's a complex and deep question that we could talk about it through any number of great thinkers who've given deep answers to that question. But if just at a very basic human level, Eric, there are people that each of us loves very, very much. And we all have a deep sense of whether they're doing well or badly. Are they struggling with addiction? Are they lonely? Have they acted self-destructively? Or are they thriving? Oh man, he's just doing so well. He's found his place, we might say. What are we talking about? What are we saying a human being is? When we say it's doing well, what does it mean? The example might be like a bird, a hawk, an eagle in full flight, or a horse at full gallop. What does it mean for a human being to be at full gallop? What does that look like? Because once you know something about that, you can say, all right, well, how do we try and build a culture that enables the realization of the wide diversity of human potential as well as we can?
I'm sorry, what? No, that's that's kind of big stuff there. And I guess these are still questions that are, you studied classics, I guess. This is where I'm going with this, is that, so you have thought about the big questions. Socrates and City is all about the big questions. And this is one of those biggest questions. What does it mean to be human? Who are we? And what are we supposed to do about it? Is that something you've always thought about, or is that something that came out of your studies in the classics?
Well, I would say both and my teacher used to say, there aren't too many questions, like not too many big questions, right? It's like,
right.
Well, what are we?
Right.
What is reality?
Yeah.
Maybe what is the first principle? What is God? And what is the relation between those things? Like, what are we? What is ultimate? And what is our relation to that? And more or less every other question, whether it's political or civic or nature, it falls within those or in some relation to those, let's say. And, on the one hand, I would say, yeah, I grew up with these things. I grew up in a big family, oldest of 10 children, grew up in a beautiful rural place, was raised as a Christian. I was taught to think about these questions about what love and forgiveness and truth and these, as in some sense we all had encounters with nature. So on the one hand, this was just sort of, yes, I think these are questions all human beings ask. Actually, I don't think it's rare to wonder, what am I? It's not rare to wonder, how can I live the one life I have in a way that is meaningful? Like, every human being as a conscious creature wants to do that. And then on the other hand, I'd say, I had the enormous privilege of teachers who enabled me, helped me, particularly through these wonderful books that had been written, 1,500
but you,
or 1,000
I mean,
years
I
ago.
I assume part of the reason you started Ralston College is because most universities shrink run from these questions. They're uncomfortable with these questions because I would say they know that they don't have good answers. So they basically avoid these questions. And when you talk about, you know, studying the classics, most of the big universities, the famous elite quote unquote universities, they're hostile to the classics.
Well, unfortunately, the many great institutions, once great institutions, have forgotten their fundamental value proposition. It's, I don't know, it's like you're a proprietor of a grocery store and you don't have any food, you know? I actually generally avoid, between us, fine, and, you know, in certain contexts, I'll use it. But I actually generally avoid the word classics, not because I'm ashamed of it, but because it's like any other label. I'd rather talk about the thing it is signifying. And what is the thing that is signifying? And it's something like the wisdom of the past, or the, you know, the humanities, or something like just the record of what other human beings have thought about human experience, whether it's history or philosophy or architecture. It's their grappling with their human experience. And, you know, my experience is human life is freaking complicated. Life is hard. Hard to figure it out. It's coming at you fast. You know, people die, get sick, you make mistakes. It's difficult to find your way. And you might say, well, if you could have access to the deepest wisdom and thoughts that other human beings had about their experience, which they tried to put in a form that they could send it to you through those entries, why would you not want to avail yourself of that?
Well,
that's what, for me, the classics fundamentally are. That's what Rawlson calls. That's why we try not to pin ourselves down by, you know, this or that kind of programmatic idea. We just say we're committed to four things: seeking the truth, the freedoms you need to seek the truth, freedom of speech, freedom of inquiry, freedom of conscience, freedom of association, the apprehension of beauty, and the community, the fellowship, friendship that makes the pursuit of those things possible.
Right.
And what we find to young people there who are so hungry for those things is just being really straight about that being what you will get if you come to us.
Yeah.
That, in fact, is what they're looking for.
Well,
they're not looking for, I don't know, just a credential or a this or a that or some kind of, you know, some sort of indoctrination.
Yeah.
Indoctrination is fundamentally a betrayal of the freedom of the human being, him or herself, and of the freedom of the student who's trying to figure it out. All we can try to do as a university, the best we can aspire to, is to be a place where they can encounter, in a context of genuine freedom of friendship, the fundamental questions of what's been thought about them in the past, and to do their best in this community to pursue those.
But this is, of course, at this point, extremely countercultural and radical and wonderful, because all of the so-called elite institutions, as I said, have abandoned all of that, completely abandoned. In fact, are bizarrely hostile to it. I mean, I remember maybe 25 or so years ago, the Bass family gave a grant of $20 million or something.
Yeah,
back when $20 million was something, to Yale, and Yale sat on it for a while and then realized, we can't take this because you want us to teach Western civilization, and we are fundamentally hostile to Western civilization. So they gave them their money back, which says a lot, really, about the presuppositions of some of these institutions. How long has Rawlson been in existence? How many students are there?
We're a relatively new college. We were legally founded in 2010. It took a long time. Colleges being fairly complex ventures to bring into being.
Yeah.
That's another story.
Yeah.
We started operations in 2022.
Yeah.
So we've just admitted our fifth class of students.
Right.
We have one program. It's a one-year graduate program, a master's in the humanities. It's kind of boot camp in Western civilization. Starts with 2 months immersive learning of Greek in Greece, ancient and modern. It's like boot camp meets the Grand Tour
immersive
on the island of
learning
Samos.
Of Greek in Greece,
yeah.
On the island of Samos?
Yeah, Pythagoras' home, as it happened. We have a class at one point. We hike up to Pythagoras' cave.
What a beautiful thing that you do this with your students.
Well, you know, there's a beautiful phrase by Plutarch, Eric, that goes something like this. The mind or the soul, he says, is not a vessel to be filled, like crammed full of things, like a suitcase or something, but a fire to be lit. And we take our students to Greece because it lights them on fire. And, you know, small, call them American conservatives, however we might want to put it. Conservatives, small c, I don't mean this in political sense. I just mean those who are trying to conserve and transmit something they think is valuable. You know, I've been complaining, you know, bitching and moaning for years about you know, the young, and, oh, they're doing young people this, they're doing that, they're going woke, oh, look at them here, marching for this, and all this kind of stuff. And, all I want to say to American conservatives is something like, you know, it's like the meme on the internet. You had one job, and you failed. There is no principle of the continuation of culture other than giving it to the young. Roger Scruton, you know, the late Roger Scruton, the great British philosopher, once said, you know, culture is just the things we have loved. And transmitting a culture is just teaching others to love them too. Mm. And when you have young people who think that the First Amendment is a threat to minorities, for goodness sakes, when it's in fact the guarantee of their voice, when you have young people who think that, you know, violence, you know, might makes right, and you might be worth having a violent kerfuffle in order to get what you want, I don't know what to tell you other than that you have radically failed. We as a culture, let's take responsibility. We have failed to transmit the things we know are true to the next generation. Mm-hmm. So I think there has to be a bit of a, let's call it a come to Jesus moment here with respect to our culture. And let's not blame the young. Yeah. Hold on a second. If the mama bears don't teach the baby bears how to fish, there's no more baby bears.
Right.
And that's the situation. I don't think there's
I'm struck by the image of baby bears fishing. It's a strange image, but I think I know what you mean.
Well, let's say hunt, whatever, you know, whatever creature it is that is teaching the young.
Without a rod and reel, I know what you're talking about. No, this is, it's beautiful, really, to think that you've done this. It's extraordinary. I don't want this only to be a commercial for Rolston College, but at the same time, I just think it's just so wonderful. I wish there were more Rolston colleges, or you could scale it more quickly.
Well, God willing, we will grow and grow relatively quickly, as quickly as we responsibly can. We're certainly seeking the support and capacity that will enable us to do that. As I said earlier about the young, they're hungry. All Rolston needs is the support to feed more of these young people who are hungry to live lives of meaning and purpose.
Yeah.
And we hope that we'll be an inspiration to other people to start new ventures. But I really do think it needs to be said that nothing less than everything is at stake in such ventures. Western civilization, it is far from clear, has any future at all. It will only have that future if we take the acts of intention, imagination, that enable the young to take up the torch.
There's no doubt about that, which is why what you're doing is so beautiful. Hey there, folks. For over 25 years, Socrates in the City and I, yours truly, have been having wonderful conversations with some of the leading minds of our time on the big questions. We think that what we're doing is important, and we need your help. Would you go to SocratesInTheCity.com/donate this month? This month, we're doing a matching campaign. All of your donations are doubled. SocratesInTheCity.com/donate. It's very important we get this out, what we do, to the widest possible audience, and your help makes it possible for us to do that. Also, while you're at SocratesInTheCity.com, please feel free to sign up for our newsletter and tell us what conversations you've enjoyed the most and what conversations you'd like to see in the future. Thank you. I want to talk to you about, you've written a book on Boethius. Who hasn't? Let's be honest. But your book is special. Boethius wrote a book called The Consolation of Boethius, and you've written a book about his book and about his thought. Most people listening have forgotten who Boethius is. I'm trying to remember what I know about Boethius, and I'm forgetting. Tell us, who know next to nothing about Boethius, who Boethius was.
So, wow, it's an amazing story. In brief, he's born in the late Roman Empire in around 475 AD. Taken into a wealthy family. His parents died. He's raised by another family. Very wealthy family. Has every privilege.
Where?
In effectively in Rome. And so he's born in the late Roman Empire, 475, it's thought. He's a brilliant young man, has the benefit of every possible educational opportunity, and he's a stunning polymath. He's an inventor, he's a mathematician, he knows about the stars and the moon. He's got mathematics, rhetoric, logic, philosophy, theology, he's got all these things. And his talents are widely acknowledged and admired. This is important to know. This is after Rome has fallen, technically, but things are kind of still seeming like they're okay, right? So there's a Ostrogothic king over top of the Senate. So if you can imagine that, you know, someone comes into the United States and they keep everything intact. They're still voting in elections. We still have a Senate. We still have others, but the president's changed into something called a king. People might think, well, this is not going well, but you know, life seems to be going kind of, for a long time. Rome continues under this.
I have to say, this is so fascinating to me, just because as I hear you talk, I realize how tremendously ignorant I am of great swaths of history. I mean, thinking about, you know, the early 6th century. So these are the early Middle Ages.
Mm-hmm.
And what do I know of that period? I mean, the idea that Rome has fallen, but as you said, there's an Ostrogothic king.
So this is what.
King.
So this
never...
is what's so interesting is that the question is, has it fallen or not? Now, technically, it has, but I think many people in Rome thought, well, your life's kind of going on as normal here. So, so Boethius rises all the way up to be the reason I mentioned the Ostrogothic king Theodoric. So he rises to be all the way up the master of offices of the entire empire. He's a very significant figure.
He's like a Joseph figure.
Yes, exactly. And then, well, got to tell the important part of the story. He sees that Rome is crumbling from within. This may seem familiar to some of us. And he understands that Rome's intellectual superstructure was actually inherited from Greece. Okay, the big ideas that are generating it.
Hmm.
And for most of Roman history, that was not only obvious, but it was obvious because everyone who was engaging with that tradition could speak fluent Greek. So, you know, Cicero and Marcus Aurelius, these could be, like I said, fluent in Greek. So they don't need translations. They just go and they read their Plato and their Homer and their Vitruvius, you know, whatever it is that they're reading, the mathematicians and so on. But in Boethius' time, Greek has been lost. He's one of the last of the Romans who has fluent Greek. And he sees the empire crumbling from within because it's lost its source, its foundation. So he says, all right, I'm going to do something about this. Greek is gone. This access to this really is, we talk about, you know, the Judeo-Christian civilization of the West.
Yeah.
I think it really needs to be said it's the Greco-Judeo-Christian, because, you know, the scriptures are written in Greek. The Romans have the inheritance. So, you know, how it's like you've got this Greek and Roman inheritance that fuses or synthesizes Christianity. That's what the West is fundamentally. And so Boethius sees this. He sees that this whole the whole foundation is being lost. And so he says, okay, what I'm going to do? I'm going to translate these key works from Greek into Latin so I can shore up the foundations for this thing. Maybe it'll last for another 1,000 years. You know, who knows what he's actually thinking the consequences will be. But what I'm trying to say is, Boethius is living in a time of absolute cultural crisis, and he thinks the answer is to go back and to bring these seeds of the past into the present. He is accused of treason by the king, thrown into prison, and a year later, brutally tortured to death. And that is the end of Boethius.
How old is Boethius?
He's coming on to 50. All of his hopes and dreams, all of his hopes of cultural renewal and civilizational regeneration brutally end with his horrific torture and death. Except while he was in prison, he wrote one last book. We don't even know how this book makes it into circulation. There's not even any record of it, so far as I know, for like 150 or 200 years. While he is in prison, he writes one last book. And this isn't a book like the other ones, which are pretty, you know, intensely, you know, technical. They're not easy reads. You know, his book on logic, for example. This book is completely different. This book is searing with human pathos and brutally honest soul searching. And it's a story about a man who's lost everything he had, who's given up on everything, wants to die, and a woman named Philosophy comes in to comfort and console him and recollect him to true self-possession. And this little book, which was written in the last weeks of his life, that we don't have any idea how it made it out into the world, goes on to become, and we talk about bestsellers these days, you know, you're a renowned author yourself. Talk about bestsellers, and we measure bestsellers in what, in weeks. How many weeks in the bestseller list? Well, Boethius's book, The Consolation of Philosophy, is effectively on the bestseller list in the West for 1,500 years. For at least 1,000 years, everyone who could read read this book. And here's what I want to say. Boethius thought, I think, in his earlier work, we're interested in cultural renewal, we're interested in doing what we can to keep the lights on. I think he thought, this could make a difference if I do this. He didn't know that after he died, it was about around the time he dies, within a few years, Rome is over. A city of 1 million people in the ancient world becomes a backwater swamp of 30,000 people. We're talking about the Dark Ages. They are at the edge of the so-called Dark Age.
Yeah.
That's what's coming. He's not saving Rome. It's over. But here's what he does do. By being faithful to what he saw, by doing his best to encounter and grapple with these fundamental questions, he could never have known that those books that he wrote, especially The Consolation of Philosophy, were like seeds that he was throwing into the future 200, 300, 400, 500 years later. They grow and lead to the revital. They effectively play an indelible role in the regeneration of the entirety of Western civilization, help to seed what happens in the Carolingian, in Renaissance, in the High Middle Ages, and then into modern, medieval and modern Europe, and including into the New World, is regenerated by the ideas and ideals that Boethius, through his faithfulness, was able to transmit to those who needed it centuries later.
Well, so I have to ask you then, what is the, I want to use the word gravamen, or what is the heart of this book that you've just described? You've just, I think you've made everyone listening just drooling to read a copy of The Consolation of Boethius the way you've described it. What is at the heart of what he says?
You might say it's the original book of self-help. You might say it's the original book of why do bad things happen to good people.
Mm-hmm.
You might say it's the original book of I'm diagnosed with cancer, I've got young children. How do I make any sense of this? I'm going to say it's the original book of, is there any order that I can find in the cosmos, in the world, that I can really understand in the midst of this total mess of injustice, of suffering, of terminal diagnoses, of political turmoil?
Is he aware of his own imminent...
We don't know. We don't know. The book, what we do know, and I encourage anyone, you know, sometimes we talk about, you know, the classics and the great books, and people go, oh, I could never read that. It's not for me. I'm just a simple guy. Well, let me tell you what. The Consolation of Philosophy, I want to tell everyone reading this, look it up, buy it tomorrow, get it on Amazon. I love the Tester translation as it happens.
The Tester translation?
I love the edition actually published by Harvard. You'll know the Loebs, these red and green books, you know, green for Greek and red for Latin.
Yeah.
I like them because they're little hardcovers you get in your hand. And it's a beautiful thing to have and hold. And anyway, pick up any copy in English, doesn't matter. I mean, this thing is written like almost like a thriller. It is. You'll be on the edge of your seat. a late friend of mine. It's quite sad to speak of a woman I was on a on a board with once. It was actually a cancer research board for the cancer my mother has that she, this woman herself had and was thought was recovering from. Anyway, the cancer came back, and she came to me and she was telling me this. It was very, very sad. Mother of young children. It was extremely sad. I didn't know what to do, you know. What do you say to someone? And I said, Carrie, anyway, I went to the, I was actually in Cambridge, and I went to the bookstore, and I, it was maybe, I didn't know if it was going to be any good or any help, but I thought, the one thing was in my heart to try and share with her was Boethius, because I don't have any words for her, but let me give her this book. It might seem a little weird, give someone a book written 1,500 years ago, and they're dealing with a terminal cancer diagnosis with three young children at home. You know, she wrote me 2 weeks later. She was a writer herself. She said, words have never meant as much to me than in this book. So the kernel of this book fundamentally is leading the person in darkness and confusion and alienation, helping them think about and understand and be recollected to a deeper abiding order in the world that they can come to see. It's not a just take my word for it. It goes through argument, but it also shows through images where you can put your trust, what is fundamental, how you can understand that what most is important to you, your own inner possession of truth, beauty, virtue, that can never be taken away from you. He says that anything that can be taken away from you was by definition never yours in the first place. You'll say, oh, that's nice looking, you know, nice looking watch you got there or whatever. Well, if someone can steal your watch, then putting your identity in this thing that someone can steal from you, that's not very stable. So the question is, what can you put your identity into that can't be taken away from you? That is like nothing, no matter. And this goes back to a teaching of Plato that you'll know. It's very powerful, a very hard teaching. Plato says, well, through one of his characters, it is better to commit than to suffer wrong. And you think, how can that be? It's better for someone to violate and hurt you and steal your things? Or,
yeah.
You know, and he says, well, you know, yes, it is. You know why? Because when you do that wrong, that's what you are. You have violated your fundamental nature. Mm. You have given up on having goodness and stability inside you because you are subject to vicious passions. Whereas if someone, terrible as it is, harms you, that's not in you. He says that vice, doing the wrong thing, he says, is its own punishment because you become the bad. You lose touch with the very things, the only things that could ever make you happy. Just as virtue, he says, is its own reward. And if you read Boethius, who's going to say this far more eloquently than I ever could, and I encourage your listeners to, I think he brings you into being able to see your inalienable, Americans, we know this word, inalienable, your inalienable freedom and connection to what is fundamental, that when you grasp it, not anyone or anything can take it away from you.
Does he speak in a Christian context, or is this coming just out of Greek and Roman philosophy?
Really good question, because we know that Boethius is the author of a series of theological tractates, including one on the Trinity, for example, so very explicitly Christian theological.
That's a pretty Christian idea right there.
There it is, exactly. It's hard to get more Christian than the idea of the Trinity, even if it's in some respects a radical modification of things that people like Plotinus thought. But what I mean to say is, we know he wrote these explicitly Christian theological tractates, but in the Consolation, no mention of Christ or Jesus. And, you know, theologians and commentators have struggled with this thing. Did he really write this? Did he give up his faith? And I think, no, I think the answer is that what he's doing, and this tells us something maybe about our own age, is he's putting things in a language of universality that anyone can understand. There are some allusions to scripture that you know, those who know the Vulgate, for example, be able to pick up on. There's nothing in it that's incompatible with. In fact, I would say he's taking the deepest insights of the Christian religion, which are compatible with and in some respects standing on the shoulders of, in a sense, the earlier tradition. And he's putting it in a language that anyone in any time can appreciate.
What is the title of your book on Boethius? His book, of course, is called
The Consolation of Philosophy.
Boethius.
No, that's my book.
His book is, Boethius's book is The Consolation of Philosophy, and your book is?
The Consolation of Boethius as Poetic Liturgy.
As Poetic Liturgy.
I know, it's a long title.
Now, I challenge you to please explain that title because I think it'll be helpful.
Okay, in brief, this book has a lot of poems in it. It goes between poetry and prose. It goes back and forth, back and forth. His book.
Not your book.
Not my book.
Boethius.
Yeah, I'm not a poet.
Right.
Boethius is a great poet, though.
Yeah.
And so you say, well, why is he doing this? Why is he sometimes talking like we're talking now and other times talking like Wordsworth or something? And, you know.
Except in Latin,
yeah. Exactly. So he's doing this in the style of Horace and the great poets. Uh-huh. And so why is he adopting these two different modes? And you might say, well, you can do the different things in poetry. You can speak an image. You can speak more to the heart. You can maybe speak at an intuitive level. But one thing that it turns out of these, say, roughly 40 poems, there's a greater variation of poetic meter or rhythm, like bum-ba-da-bum-ba-da-bum or dum-da-dum-da-dum, you know, than in any other text that survives from the ancient world. You think, well, that's a bit. Kidding me?
It's certainly
in a prison cell?
Certainly ambitious.
Why would that be the case?
Wow.
And I came to the idea that this lady philosophy was using these different rhythms to kind of like you might, you know, if you, all your listeners will know, if you have an upset little infant, you know, what do you do? Tap, 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 tap. You know, other music makes you want to get up and dance. So, you know, rhythm has an effect on the soul. And so I came to the idea that what was going on with these rhythms, where they were an acoustic part of the therapy that was being being offered and administered to him. And that would be a very brilliant and original thesis if it were not stated very clearly on the third page of Boethius's book. Lady Philosophy says she expels the muses of poetry that are sort of the book starts with Boethius saying, I was just, the muses of poetry were dictating to me. It's kind of a woe is me poem. And he portrays it as a kind of passive, oh my goodness, you're sitting in bed, you know, you've had a bad thing. You're laying in bed, you're eating ice cream or whatever. You're feeling sorry for yourself, you're depressed. That's how the book starts, right? He is in the dumps. And she comes in like just blazing, and she expels these music for poetry. She says, they have no cure for a man's ills. They only make it worse. It's like feel sorry for me music sort of thing. Feeling sorry for myself,
right,
music.
Right.
And then she says, leave him to my muses to heal and make whole. And I go, what's going on there? It seems that what she's saying is in the right hands, these incredible powers of poetry can be used to heal you. And the only thing I also need to say is that what I discovered, because that's said very explicitly on the third page of the book, what I discovered, Eric, is that if you map out these different rhythms, no one had done this really before. This is, I suppose, what my work discovers. You have an incredibly intricate pattern that emerges. It's like you're walking into a cave, and you can't see anything, and then you light a torch and your eyes start to adjust, and then you see on the ceiling is this magnificent tapestry of order. That's what's going on acoustically in Boethius's poetry. And I think what is happening is that it's a patterning of sound that recollects the soul to stability. And I suggest that that gives the book as a whole the character of liturgy. Because what is liturgy other than a repetition that patterns us into and in a way that we can see what is eternal?
But what kind of a freakish genius are we talking about who would write this in prison at the end of his life? This is, you know, there's kind of a reason this has lasted for 1,500 years, I'm guessing.
Mm.
This is... I never thought I'd be champing at the bit to read Boethius, but you've done it. Seriously, how extraordinary, how beautiful, and how wonderful that so many people tuning in to us will want to read Boethius too. Your book is published by Oxford University Press, so these aren't just some crackpot ideas. Oxford University seems to think that they're worth publishing, but to write a book about Boethius, what led you to want to write the book on Boethius, of all the things you could have written about?
Well,
or maybe let me also ask you, because when I write a book first, I want to see, has anyone else written anything like this? It doesn't seem that anyone has.
Well, there was a German scholar who'd done some work in the poetry. You know, the Germans are like this. They try and systematize, and they're as a culture, good at that. I just followed my nose. The book, you know, I think what I say to your listeners is the book had been meaningful to me at times in my life when I was trying to make sense of things. And so I wrote a master's thesis many years ago on that, and then went off to do a PhD at here in the States, and had some further thoughts that and further experiences that led me to wonder about, you know, what was going on here, what was going on with these. I'd actually had the opportunity to study Latin with a man named Reginald Foster that some of your listeners may know. He's a Carmelite, he's an American Carmelite priest, became the Pope's Latinist, one of the greatest Latinists in
which
history.
Which Pope?
This was, over many popes, from the 70s he was there all the way through till under Benedict, if I'm not mistaken. So he was there for many, many years. And he was an incredible teacher, but he ran for free. He taught for free courses on Latin that anyone come to be. And I couldn't believe it. Here I thought Latin was this kind of silent, you know, code or something. I don't know. That's how stupid I was. I wouldn't have realized that it was a language that, you know, just like you'd speak to your swear into your breath or talk to your dog or you know, write poetry in it. It had sound. It's just like everything else. Of course, it's obvious to anyone who says it, but it hadn't really occurred to me that...
Not that many people, maybe it's just the circles in which I travel, but not that many people seem to speak Latin.
Yeah, fewer than they're used to, and I don't have any fluency in these languages, not like I'd like to, but actually, it's one of the things we do at Ralston College. We teach these languages in a way that people can speak them, because that's how they were taught for all of history until like yesterday. And there's a reason that we're losing our touch with our past, because we don't have the tools to read it. These are languages that no harder to learn Greek than it is to learn French or English. I mean, you just have to be immersed in it, and you can become a fluent speaker of this. That's why we teach through the direct method, so students can, you know, our students don't even know the Greek alphabet when they show up. And why should they? They're not any expected to as a requirement of admission. But by Christmas, they've all read the Gospel of John in Greek, start to finish.
See, now that's crazy and beautiful. That's amazing that you start in the fall, and that in that fast of a time, you're able to read the Gospel of John.
That's
impressive.
It.
So when you say Greek, Koine Greek.
We teach them both ancient and modern, and they study ancient of all periods.
But I mean,
Homeric, Attic, and Koine. Or Kine, as the modern Greeks would call it.
Wow, yeah.
And, you know, the Greek language effectively is a single language, but in a long continuum with a long evolution.
You avoid katharevousa.
We don't teach them katharevousa.
How many students are at Ralston College?
We have 25 students right now.
As we speak. So you are, okay, but you're going to scale this. And
yeah,
I'm very excited.
We wanted to start small, and, you know, the idea was let's try and do this at the highest possible level. For a small group, you know, when you're starting ventures, you know, your small mistakes at the beginning become big mistakes if you multiply them by 10. And so we wanted to really work out the kinks and do this as the absolute. It also was an experiment. Is it even possible to start a new college? Is it possible you get some of the most talented young people, some of the most renowned teachers in the world, to come to a new college? That was a question.
We have
found the answer is yes to both of those.
But it's just right now it's just a 1 year master's.
That's right. And the next stage for us will be to launch an undergraduate program.
Right.
To take what we've learned about how to teach these things in living and effective and very rigorous and exciting, inspiring ways into a curriculum of an undergraduate degree.
And after the 2 months in Samos, where did the students go?
They come to Savannah.
Georgia.
Savannah, Georgia, one of the most beautiful cities in the U.S., and they have 3 2-month periods in Savannah. Really, from October through to May, they're in Savannah, but through 3 intensive 2-month quarters
of
terms. And those go ancient, medieval, modern. They keep studying Greek, but then they begin the program opens up,
right?
And they're going in seminars and lectures in English as they read and write their way through weekly papers through some of the sort of titanic, most influential, informative texts and ideas of the Western tradition.
Do they read Boethius?
They do. They do get to spend a week with Boethius, yeah. Which is wonderful.
Well, it's been wonderful and encouraging talking to you. I wish I had enough time to get a master's at Ralston next year.
So do I.
Because sure sounds like fun, and I think you'll be overwhelmed. I hope not too many people watch this video, because you'll be overwhelmed. You won't have any time to read all the applications. It's going to be a very difficult year for you. So we'll try to make sure not to make the algorithm doesn't let too many people see this video. Stephen Blackwood, a joy speaking with you. Congratulations on what you're doing, and thank you for your thoughts. And let me simply say, to be continued. Thanks.
It's a privilege to be here. Thanks for having me.
If you think these conversations are valuable, would you do us a favor and please like this video and subscribe to this channel? When you do that, you help us get these conversations out to a wider audience by telling YouTube that people are interested in this. Also, you can go to SocratesInTheCity.com, sign up for our newsletter, and you can check back every week. There's new stuff here every week. Thank you for tuning in.